Well, this morning, we are, by the grace of God, wrapping up our study of the book of Esther as we look primarily at chapter 9, though there's a very short chapter 10 attached to it as well. And for those who are visiting, we have been for a couple months now considering this unusual Old Testament book and seeing so many ways in which the hidden hand of God has been active and how the Lord behind the scenes has been working in the midst of desperate circumstances to bless and to protect and to provide for his people. And I struggled about how to wrap this up or even if to do that this morning, because when you look at the text of what's in front of us, it's a pretty lengthy set of verses. And yet it would be difficult to divide this up. I think we would easily lose the message, the continuity, the emphasis that all of this passage together is bringing out as this story concludes. So I do plan to finish up the series this morning. And you might be wondering, what are you going to do after that? And the answer is, I'm not entirely sure, but I have a week. And I do have some things in mind, particularly for a shorter series as we head into this fall. Maybe doing smaller things through the end of this year before we get into another major study of a further book of the Bible. But I do ask you to pray that the Lord would guide and that I would have his direction as we come back to meet together again this coming Sunday. But here we are at the end of Esther, and I was struck by the connection between this passage and something hugely important that happened this week. Of course, there have been a lot of things going on in the news this week. One of the things that took place has not received, I think, the attention it should have. It was a historic moment that took place on Tuesday. Perhaps you saw the pictures of our president with three individuals that represented three of the countries in the Middle East. And they were there to sign what is known as the Abraham Accords. And of course, that was the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and then also the foreign ministers of the UAE and Bahrain, where they were setting aside decades upon decades of coldness, hostility, avoidance, and agreeing to establish formal diplomatic relations. This was a major move on their parts and really quite a striking development that has been under development for some time and now giving fruit. It is remarkable, as you read the Bible compared to current events, the ongoing hostility that even to this day is faced by the nation of Israel. And I'm not one to read the newspaper and interpret the Bible in that light, or to be making all kinds of connections between every next thing that happens and something specific the Bible says. I think there's a murkiness about some of this. We know that in this case, the reason that that accord was signed was not because these people all of a sudden became friendly to Israel and just wanted to have a great relationship with them. It's really more a matter of joining with them against a greater threat, which is Iran. And the theological differences between the Iranian regime and their version of Islam and that which is held by these other people, and also the fact that the Iranians are developing evidently as a nuclear force in the world. And so it's really a matter of politically deciding what is most advantageous at the moment. Exactly what this is going to mean in the long term, I'm not entirely sure. But nevertheless, the fact that the people of Israel continue to be such a focal point in current events, thousands of years after what we're reading, and it's all about basically people hating Israel, people trying to get rid of this one nation that actually doesn't occupy that much territory on the globe. I think we're looking at something of the providence of God, just like we're seeing it in Esther. And this is going to receive its ultimate resolution, I believe, in the end times. I want to start this morning by sharing with you some unusual statements that we find at the end of the book of Zechariah. When, of course, we expect the Lord to set up his kingdom centered in Jerusalem, and what's going to be the relationship between Israel at that point and the rest of the nations of the world. We read this kind of thing in Zechariah chapter 14, that everyone who survives of all the nations that have come against Jerusalem shall go up year after year to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Booths. So you're going to have representatives, we're not sure what the names of all these countries may be at that point, but from all these parts of the world coming to Jerusalem actually to worship the God of Israel. And you say, well, what if somebody doesn't want to come? What if they're dug in and they continue in their negativity toward Israel? Listen to this. If any of the families of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the king, the Lord of hosts, there will be no rain on them. God's going to judge them. God's going to deal with them through famine. And if the family of Egypt does not go up and present themselves, then on them there shall be no rain. There shall be the plague with which the Lord afflicts the nations that do not go up to keep the Feast of Booths. This shall be the punishment to Egypt and the punishment to all the nations that do not go up to keep the Feast of Booths. The point is, God takes it seriously. Not only when people don't worship him, but when people are aligning themselves against his chosen people, the nation of Israel. And he's going to maintain that commitment to them all the way up through the end of human history. And that is what we're seeing. As we come to the book of Esther, we're seeing a major historical example of just how committed God is to his people and just how opposed he is to those who hate his people. And this story has been really resolved in principle already, but now we're seeing in chapter 9 and toward the end here in chapter 10 as well, the final working out of what had already been determined in the passages that we have looked at already. And so the title of the message this morning is Providential Denouement, which of course is a French word that refers to what tends to happen at the end of a good story when after a period of intense conflict over something, things settle down to a peaceful conclusion and the conflict is resolved and life now can go on to the next thing. That's what we're looking at here as we come to the end. And we find that there are various elements of that resolution as we go through the different sections of this passage. The resolution itself really takes place and is over with in the first 19 verses. The rest is basically a party after that. And so as we look at the first 19 verses, you could capture it this way as to what the Lord is doing in this section, that the work of providence reverses threats against God's people. And as we read this, you're going to see the systematic undoing of everything that Haman had determined against the people of God. You're going to see the systematic overturning of all the efforts at that time to do away with Israel and to deal with them decisively once for all. The Lord turns everything around in the opposite direction. He has set up for that through the preceding chapters, and his providence now is working it out to the fullest. He is actively and concretely reversing those threats, all of those threats against his people. So be looking for that as I read now verses 1 to 19. Now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. That is the introductory, the summary statement. The key word is reverse. Everything turned in the opposite direction. And now specifically, verse 2, the Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men, and also killed Parshan Datha, and Dalphon, and Aspatha, and Paratha, and Adaliah, and Aridatha, and Parmeshta, and Arisai, and Aridai, and Vizatha, the 10 sons of Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, but they laid no hand on the plunder. That very day, the number of those killed in Susa the citadel was reported to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, "In Susa the citadel, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men, and also the 10 sons of Haman. What then have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now what is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what further is your request? It shall be fulfilled." And Esther said, "If it please the king, let the Jews who are in Susa be allowed tomorrow also to do according to this day's edict, and let the 10 sons of Haman be hanged on the gallows." So the king commanded this to be done. A decree was issued in Susa, and the 10 sons of Haman were hanged. The Jews who were in Susa gathered also on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they killed 300 men in Susa, but they laid no hands on the plunder. Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's provinces also gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who hated them, but they laid no hands on the plunder. This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th day they rested and made that day a day of feasting and gladness. But the Jews who were in Susa gathered on the 13th day, and on the 14th, and rested on the 15th day, making that a day of feasting and gladness. Therefore, the Jews of the villages who live in the rural towns hold the 14th day of the month of Adar as a day of gladness and feasting, as a holiday, and as a day on which they send gifts of food to one another. This is the record of the resolution worked out by the providence of God. The work of providence reverses threats against God's people. And in what I read there, we're going to see a pretty long list of aspects that had been working against the people of God that on this day were all of a sudden reversed. Let's consider what these aspects of reversal are. It really is an impressive list of items. First of all, it begins by saying that this has to do with who was in charge. Instead of the enemies gaining the mastery over Jews, it worked out the opposite. The Jews were the ones who had the authority. They were the ones who are described here as having mastery. And then there's also the element of fear that is mentioned twice, actually, in verse 2 and also in verse 3. That's a turnaround, because when the decree of Haman originally came out, what happened? It was the Jews who were struck with panic. It was the people of God who were overwhelmed by fear. They're throwing ashes on their head. They're wearing sackcloth. They're crying out to the Lord because they're afraid of what's going to happen. Now, all of a sudden, even though they are a minority in the land, it is clear that the government is behind them, and the work of God is so extensive that it not only leads to the destruction of the enemy, but their own hearts are melting with fear. That's incredible. That is totally unexpected if you understand that these were people that were actually subjugated by the Persian government, that were actually in exile, that had been destroyed, and that were there basically as prisoners. And now everybody's afraid of them, of all people. That's not the first time that that has ever happened. In fact, when you read the opening accounts of the history of Israel, God makes this point that this is the way it's going to be between God, between Israel and her enemies. And so let me give you some verses along those lines. Here's a promise the Lord makes when it comes to the people going into the land of Canaan. He says in Exodus, "I will send my terror before you and will throw into confusion all the people against whom you shall come. And I will make all your enemies turn their backs to you." And he repeats that in Deuteronomy chapter 2. "This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you on the peoples who are under the whole heaven, who shall hear the report of you and shall tremble and be in anguish because of you." And then chapter 11, "No one shall be able to stand against you. The Lord your God will lay the fear of you and the dread of you on all the land that you shall tread as he promised you." And all you have to do is read into the next book, which is the book of Joshua. And as those spies are sent into the city of Jericho and they start to have a conversation with Rahab about what was going on and how the people of Jericho were thinking about this other people that was gathering outside their walls, what does she say? You can check it out. She says, "Our hearts have melted in fear because we heard the story," and actually the story is about something that happened 40 years earlier when God parted the Jordan, and everything up to that point, they had heard the accounts, and God used the records and the stories of what had taken place to fill the heart of the enemy with fear, to where they just did not have the courage to stand up, or it was just inevitable from their standpoint. That is the ability of God to work on behalf of his people. And here, all of these years later, like 1,000 years later, he's doing the same kind of work as far as the Persians who are opposing the people of God. A total reversal of how this book started. But there is more to it than that. In verse 3, we read that all of the officials now of the Persian government are not just giving them permission to do this, but they're actively siding with them. They're visibly taking their side, and they're saying, "We're willing to help you. We're willing to help you to defend yourself against whatever attacker may come." So all of the people that before had been at the bidding of Haman have now turned in their attitude as far as who they're going to help. There is a change, of course, in leadership as well in verse 4, where up to this point it had been all about Haman carrying out what he wanted, Haman growing in power, Haman getting so much influence that he was able to pull off this decree. And now it says everything changed. What's reversing here is that now Mordecai, Haman's arch enemy, is the one who is growing more and more in power. And then there's another element in verse 5. Maybe you picked up on this as you thought about some of the comments that we have run across before. Look at verse 5, and as it describes the self-defense killing that takes place, it says that the Jews did as they pleased to those who hated them. Does that ring a bell? Remember all those times leading up to this situation that we talked about, Xerxes and Haman as well, and they were all about what? They were doing whatever was good in their eyes. And there's all of this about if it please you, if it please you this, if it please you the other. And these people in authority are acting according to their pleasure, according to whatever they define as good and delightful and enjoyable, whatever they feel like doing. And now that reversal happens as well, where it is the people of God who have the opportunity to do what they deem best in this circumstance. And really, the only thing that is appropriate is the wiping out of their enemies. And then the longest section of this relates the story of the death, the actual death of all their enemies. A total of 800 people in Susa, and then the overall total, as you consider the provinces, 75,000 of their enemies make the effort to attack, make the effort to carry out the original decree, and they are judged by God through the Jews with death for themselves. That's a lot of people who lost their lives on this occasion. And it is totally the opposite of where the action had been going. And there is a special emphasis in describing those deaths. There's a special emphasis on those 10 names that we find it difficult to pronounce, the 10 sons of Haman. It's like the Lord wants to make sure you know all the bases were covered. And actually, it was pretty common in these empires when a king was assassinated or there was some kind of coup, they didn't want any possibility that one of the sons is going to somehow find a way to take authority back for himself. So it was pretty traditional, actually, for the sons of a deposed king to be executed as well. And in the justice of God, and perhaps as a part of this, that this family had been supporting Haman and had been involved in the process of trying to destroy the Jewish people, they actually, every one of them, all 10 of his sons, lose their lives, and they are named by name. The Lord is saying, I've covered the base. There are no more Haman kind of people out there left. And I'm gonna string their names together in a list and slow down the story a bit. And you're going to have to read and, in our case, wrestle through the pronunciation of the names, because I want you to work through to the last detail every last person that needed to be judged. They're mentioned here by name, the sons of Haman. And it is very interesting to read about some of the Jewish traditions when it comes to those sons of Haman. I took a picture of Esther chapter 9 in one of my Hebrew Bibles, and I'm going to put that picture up for you here. Those of you who studied Hebrew or just happen to look at a Hebrew Bible know that it's just a lot of words strung together, and of course, if you don't know the language, you get lost very easily. And they don't really have the sort of typographical the settings that we're used to if we're using word processors and such, where you can bold something, where you can italicize something, where you can tab something over, where you can make it a bigger font, or you can set it off in some way with a heading, or you know, put arrows pointing to it. They don't have all of those kinds of things, but they do have some things they can do. And the more and more that this story was copied, you want to remember that for hundreds of years, this was being copied by hand. As you look at the manuscripts that we have, this became the tradition for how this was handled. It is extremely rare in the Hebrew Bible for something to be formatted this way. And you can look at the difference between what's on the right side of the page, which is a normal page from the Hebrew Bible, and what's on the left side, and you see all of that blank space. And what they're doing is they're putting an individual name of a son of Haman, and then they're putting the little connector, which is our word "and" basically, on the other end, and then going back to the other margin, and there's just the one name on that line, and they get all of this extra space. This is highly unusual in the way that the Hebrew Bible was copied. And it's like the scribes are just shouting, and they're like, look at this guy and think about him as an individual. Before you go to the next guy, look at his name and say it and get it that this was an individual. They're really slowing down and elaborating on this, even in the way that they're formatting the page. And then there are different theories about actually what people had in mind originally. Some people say, well, they put it that way actually so they would say it real fast and just kind of in one breath get through the list of these bad guys. And just making it all very clear what you need to say there and going through it quickly. Other people say, actually, when you look at that, it's like these names are sort of hanging in a line. And that is supposed to represent the fact that these men were hung on gallows. And you're sort of visualizing there these bodies that are just waving from a rope or something as they are hung. Interesting theories. Actually, it gets crazier than that. And some of the things that I found, I'm not going to distract too much from the message. But from the standpoint of the author of Esther, he wants you to know that every last one of these people were dealt with in the justice of God. And there are other reversals as well. We made a point a number of times about Xerxes and what a sort of pushover he was and how he didn't exert a lot of initiative as a leader, but he was very liable to being manipulated, whether it was by Haman or later by Esther herself. And yet, there is something pretty different when what happens here in the passage that I read. Did you pick up on it that after the summary is given of what took place, starting in verse 11, it is the king that approaches Esther now, and it's like he's saying, are you okay? Is this taken care of, honey? Is there any more that we need to do? What would be good to you? That is not Xerxes. That's not the way he's presented himself. There is a reversal in the initiative that he is taking. And it's another stroke of the providence of God that he has so worked in this man to side with Esther that now he is taking the initiative, not just to give her permission. Before it was all about Esther sticking her neck out and, you know, making this very extreme request. But now the king is taking the initiative to ask her what she wants. And she says, well, actually, maybe we should give it another day. If it pleased the king, right? Can we give it another day to make sure that this is thoroughly accomplished in case somebody out there says, well, they only had permission for one day to defend themselves. We'll just wait till the next day to attack them. She says, in case there's anybody out there like that, would you give us permission for one more day to defend ourselves? And sure enough, another 300 people are executed in that regard. It's pretty amazing that the king is taking that kind of initiative after everything we've seen in this story. Then did you notice something else? That three times in that story, it says that even though they killed these people, they laid no hand on the plunder. Three times that comment is made in the text. Verse 10, verse 15, and verse 16. That's unusual because if you remember the decree that they signed in the previous chapter, actually it said they were given permission to take the plunder of their enemies. That was a part of them asserting themselves or showing that they were victorious and they got to enjoy the loot of their enemies. It was okay as far as the law was concerned, but in this case, they actually chose not to take it to the full extent of the law, and they kept their hands off of the plunder. Why would they do that? This is not normal behavior on the part of soldiers in the ancient world. Why would they choose to do that here? You had expected, based upon the previous, that they would take that opportunity and seek personal gain. But again, it's like the author is shouting and making a point. He says it three times. They did not take the plunder. Why would they do that? Well, there's a background to this that we'll get into in just a moment, but I think as you look at it, the conclusion is this. This was not about them and opening up an opportunity for them to become rich. This was a God thing. This was about the Lord using them to execute judgment on their enemies. It was not an opportunity for them to get more wealthy. And it seems to be they wanted everybody to know that. That we, number one, aren't going out and attacking these people. This is self-defense, and we're not even going to take their stuff, even though we could. We're doing the bare minimum to deal with this crisis, and we're not going to use it as an opportunity for personal enrichment, because that would actually communicate the wrong thing about what this is about. And the main reason I would come to that conclusion, which is how this is typically understood, is because there's also another aspect of reversal going on here, where this is different from a very similar situation in the past. And the wording of a parallel passage, this is different from that passage. And I'm talking about the scenario with Saul. Let me remind you that Haman is identified as an Agagite. And that the reason he's even there to begin with and this whole problem starts is because back in the day, Saul did not thoroughly bring about the judgment that God told him to bring about on Agag, who was an Amalekite, people that were under the curse of God because of their aggressive opposition to the people of Israel, going all the way back to the beginning of their history. And now is finally the time to deal thoroughly with this, and Saul does a half job about it. And I want to read to you the wording in 1 Samuel chapter 15. Samuel is talking to Saul about that. He says, "The Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go devote to destruction the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed.' Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord?" And of course, Saul's gonna come up with an excuse. "Oh, it was the people's idea. Oh, I wanted to keep back something to offer to the Lord as a sacrifice." And Samuel looks at him and says, "To obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams. This is an issue of your unwillingness to do God's work thoroughly." And dealing with this little war here in the customary way that people do war in that time, keeping back stuff for yourself, and maybe even looking for a way to make a peace treaty with the king, with Agag, and it gets pretty gruesome. As you read on the story, Samuel not only rebukes Saul, but he goes in there and says he just hacked Agag to pieces. Because again, this man and his people were under the judgment of God, and a thorough job was not done. Some of the Agagites apparently were allowed to escape, and that's how the line continued, even to the days of Esther. And at this point, the people of God are not pouncing on the spoil. They're taking a hands-off attitude. They're saying, "We're just doing the minimal work that has to be done and doing what the Lord has authorized us to do and what he desires. We're not touching any of this stuff." And that is a reversal of the great mistake that Saul made and that led to so many devastating consequences in his own life. Things are being turned around here. And then as you come to the end of it, verses 17 to 19, there's also a reversal in terms of feasting. And after they carry out this judgment, they take a day to celebrate, a day of gladness and feasting, a holiday, and sending gifts of food to one another. Well, have there been feasts before in this book? Most of the feasts have had to do with the enemies of God living their hedonistic lives, and abusing other people in the process, and what they're celebrating are not necessarily wholesome things and things that would please the Lord, and it's just about their own personal enjoyment. Well, there's enjoyment here, but it is a reversal that now it's the people of God that are feasting. They're the ones taking up the role of celebration. They're the ones that are enjoying a moment of victory here. Things have turned around where before they were excluded, they were marginalized, they were threatened. Other people were having parties. Now they get to have a party. The Lord has turned it around even to that point. Now that is an impressive list. And what might have seemed like a very boring little passage here, not a whole lot of information theologically, is actually pointed to the Lord in all kinds of ways. And I want to say one other thing as we ask, why was it the Lord did it, and why did he do it so thoroughly? There is actually, again, looking back in the Old Testament, a strong foundation, a basis for this. And that basis is the promise of God on behalf of his people. And not going even back to earlier historical incidents that were like this, but going back even beyond Exodus, all the way back to Genesis, in the very first thing God told Abraham about his people. And he laid out there some initial and general sort of big picture blessings. And in those blessings, one of the initial promises that the Lord makes in the Abrahamic covenant is what? He not only says, I'm going to bless those who bless you, but he also says, I'm going to curse those who curse you. That is what we're seeing in Esther chapter 9. It is a fulfillment of that promise of the Abrahamic covenant. That to the degree that peoples rise up to oppose and to curse the people of Israel, God is going to set himself in opposition, and it's not going to be pretty. His own character, his own reputation, his own faithfulness is on the line here. It's not just about rescuing these people because of being humane. It's because he has made promises to them. And those promises included something negative toward those who would set themselves in hostility against his people. I like the way that one commentator put it. It may be agreed that this episode, what we've just read, is reported, it's just giving you a report of what happened, lacking the vivid drama and action of previous scenes. However, the change in style is purposeful. The motivation for this downshift in style is theological. Because Mordecai's decree expressed God's ancient decree of survival for his people and the destruction of their enemies, it was a done deal before the day dawned. The decree, in effect, guaranteed the outcome. The author is showing it is God's decree, his word, that assures the survival of his people. The rest is just detail. It was already a done deal in the earlier chapter. Now it's just the working out of it. But it is important detail because it shows that God's word is truly effective in the outworking of human history. God is capable of doing exactly what he says he will do, even centuries after he says it. This episode highlights the powerful efficacy of God's word as it is actualized in history through flawed and even evil people. All of those reversals, theologically, the main point is this: God is faithful to his word. And against all odds, God's going to maintain and carry through his commitments to Israel, including that those who curse them, sadly, will be cursed as well. A couple of weeks ago, I was preaching on Esther, and there was a couple here who were recently retired missionaries to Germany. And after the message, he shared with me a story related to this book that I got curious about and ran down. And it's just exactly parallel to what we're seeing here as a later demonstration of this kind of thing. If you study the history of World War II and the sort of things that Hitler said and did about the Jews, he is, to an extreme, a modern-day Haman. And we're familiar with the millions of Jewish people who lost their lives in the Holocaust. And in 1942, one of the things that the Nazis did was that they shot 10 Jewish men in a city in Poland. Specifically, it was said, to avenge the lives of the 10 sons of Haman. And a couple years later, and things at this point were not looking good for the Nazis, Hitler actually said that if the Jews and their side wins this war, they're going to have a second Purim, a second opportunity to celebrate victory over their enemies like was done in Esther. Actually, one of the things that Hitler did was to prohibit the Jewish people to have copies of the Book of Esther. And if in the concentration camps a Jew was found with a copy of Esther, the decision was immediate execution. No waiting for a gas chamber, no waiting for anything. This is an immediate capital offense because of how offensive the resolution of Esther was to somebody like Hitler and what he was out to do. Well, of course, we know that in the providence of God, the Axis powers were soundly defeated. And the year after the war ended, they held the Nuremberg trials, where remaining Nazis were put on trial for all these crimes committed against humanity. One of the men, there were 11 men that were condemned pretty early on. One of them was Hermann Göring. And rather than face the execution that he deserved, he actually committed suicide. And there is an old Jewish tradition that says that Haman had a daughter who, rather than having to undergo this, she actually committed suicide. And guess what happened to the other 10 Nazis? And this was October 1946. They died by hanging. And one of those men, as he approached the gallows where he would lose his life, he said, "Purim Fest 1946. He could see the hand of God. He could see that the Lord reversed everything for the Germans, just like he did for Haman. And he was experiencing 10 men, just like these 10. He was experiencing the outworking of the judgment of God and fulfillment of his promise. It is a sobering thing. It is a fearful thing as you consider, even to this day, all the nations rising up against Israel. But the Lord is going to have his way, and the work of providence is going to reverse in God's time all of the threats that are being faced by his people. Those that are left over who see that work, we come to the next part of the passage in chapter 9, and here is the truth. The work of providence merits celebration. The passage had already told you about their feasting and so forth, but it really goes, here's another case where it just kind of goes on and on. It didn't have to give you all this information. But look at verse 20. "And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obligating them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar, and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned, reversal, for them from sorrow into gladness, from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts of the poor. So the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast pure, that is, cast lots to crush and to destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head." There's another kind of reversal. and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore, they call these days Purim, after the term pure or poor. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter and of what they had faced in this matter and of what had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at the time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation and every clan, province, and city, and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, notice that her Jewish parentage is brought back into the picture very visibly, and Mordecai, the Jew, gave full written authority confirming this second letter about Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus in words of peace and truth, that these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed seasons as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them and as they had obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their fast and their lamenting. The command of Queen Esther confirmed these practices of Purim and it was recorded in writing. Now, what are we going to say about that section that again goes on and on about this new festival here? They thought it was worth commemorating with an annual celebration that remembered and praised God and delighted in what he had accomplished for them. Just as we saw aspects of the reversal, let's consider quickly some aspects of the celebration. I think I've pointed out in the past that this book, its structure is organized according to paired things. There's Vashti and Esther. There is Haman and Mordecai. There are these pairs of feasts that show up throughout the book. And here as well, it is interesting that you go on with this pattern of two things that go together. There are two letters. The first one from Mordecai, sending out the decree about the feast. There's a second one that Esther sends out to confirm it. There are 2 days that are involved because the people in Susa got an extra day, and it's a little unclear exactly how they were thinking, whether everybody was supposed to celebrate 2 days or, as is now commonly done, even in modern times, that Purim is celebrated 1 day by most of the Jews, but people that live in the wall, what are traditionally the walled cities of Israel, like Jerusalem, they celebrate on a different day as they sort of connect themselves to the people in Susa. But there are 2 days associated with this feast, however that works. And as I tried to point it out in reading, the emphasis is on the idea of reversal. There's that kind of language of turning around, turning everything in an opposite direction in verse 22, verse 25, verse 31. And then the name of this feast, what is the point of calling it the Feast of Lots, L-O-T-S, the Hebrew word Purim? Well, that is to remember that in trying to seek the will of his gods, Haman was casting lots to try to determine what day he would carry out his pogrom. And they want to remember that something that, number one, he thought that his own gods had decided, and that to other people might have seemed just like a random thing. It just kind of fell out on this particular month. That happened to be like a year away. That gave him some time to figure out a resolution, right? Actually, the Bible says, these people's Bible says, Proverbs 16:33, the lot is cast into the lap, but the whole disposing thereof is of the Lord. That was a way by which they were saying God, in his wisdom and power, directed even these dice that were being thrown to land on the exact month and the exact year. That's when he would work to deliver us. And that name that relates to something seemingly random like lots is attributed to his providence, and it was through those physical lots that he determined the lot or the portion of his people. And that was the focal point of this celebration. It's all about commemorating the amazing providence of God over little things as well as big things. And then did you notice this language about he obligated them, or she obligated them, and they obligated themselves. It shows up in particularly verses 27 to 28. That corresponds to something else in the book. Remember, there was the emphasis on the laws of the Persians cannot be revoked. This is firm. Nobody, we're committed to it. We can't change this. And now corresponding to that, here at the end, the people are saying, all right, here's something we're going to unchangeably commit ourselves to. Just like those laws supposedly couldn't be undone, we're going to obligate ourselves permanently, generation after generation. This may not ever be revoked. And to this day, come the spring, even to this day, the Jews are still celebrating this feast. And here's another parallel that I ran across. At the end of chapter 1, the way that Xerxes tried to resolve his marital problems is to send out a letter throughout the empire and say, all the women have to submit to their husbands. You people better not be trying to pull off what Vashti did. And here's a man sending out a letter and sort of mocking or putting down his wife, right? Who gets the last word in this book as far as letters are concerned? The last letter comes from a woman. She's the queen. She's taking the initiative here. In the providence of God, she has the authority to send out a letter and say, you people, in all these 127 provinces, you're going to do this. You get the message. We are going to celebrate the working of God, and the letter comes precisely from a woman. And it is fascinating to read about some of the traditions of how the Jews celebrate Purim to this day. Here's something that you will see as they gather together to have the book of Esther, the whole story, read out loud in their synagogue or whatever on Purim. That's a noisemaker. And what happens is every time the reader comes to the name Haman, people start stomping their feet and twirling this thing and booing Haman as the bad guy, as the enemy of God's people. That's what they do to this day. And the passage talks about them sending out food as a part of the celebration. That's a lot like Christmas, right? We eat extra things, we eat sweet things as a part of enjoying the season. Here's a picture of one of the things that they eat. This is a pastry known as hamantaschen. And it's kind of like shortbread that they can fill with different sweets or cheese or whatever as something special, a treat for this occasion. The word hamantaschen in Yiddish, which is where that comes from, it means Haman's pockets. And it may be that that's a reference to the pockets of Haman, as it were, that he was trying to fill with money as he grew more and more powerful and was opposing the Jews. But actually, the Hebrew version of the name for this means Haman's ears. And you can picture these people chomping on the ears of Haman as they have this party every year. Other people have suggested that actually that looks like some of the dice that have been discovered in Babylon, and that maybe that's the origin. But either way, it is just so striking, confirmatory, encouraging that to this day the people of God are still doing what this story lays out for them as the practice for celebration. And this is just a little footnote. I know we're going long, but I told you that this was a longer passage than usual. So you got the rest of the day to do whatever you're going to do. In Protestant circles, there is often a debate between what's called the regulative principle of worship and the normative principle of worship. And the normative idea is what was taught by Luther, that basically if God doesn't prohibit something in Scripture, then we may do that thing in worship. And so that's why there's a lot of emphasis on robes and candles, and even in some cases people are using this to justify other things that the Bible doesn't say you can't do, so we can do it. The Reformed tradition teaches what's called the regulative principle of worship, which of course means that God's word regulates our worship, and it does it by giving us exactly what we are to do. And it's not just do whatever isn't forbidden, but only do that which is commanded actively. Now, what does that have to do with this? Why am I bringing this up? Well, I think, and historically this kind of thing has been used in this discussion, a book like Esther actually teaches us that neither of those is quite the right way to frame it. And the reason is, from what we see here, God never told them to have this feast. It was never actively commanded that they should add to their calendar of worship a new thing and require everybody else to do it. So it's not necessarily strict command or direct warrant, as normally is understood with regulative principle. However, it is still regulated by the word of God in the sense that it's picking up on patterns. God doesn't give us an exhaustive list of what we're to do in worship. But he has, in the case of Israel, he has instituted some feasts, and they're all about remembering the past. They're all about celebrating God's work and grace. And these people say, hey, if they were celebrating the Exodus, I mean, this is a huge deliverance like the Exodus. Our whole people could have been wiped out. And humanly speaking, where was the Messiah going to come from? This is huge. Let's celebrate it. Kind of like what they did over there. And you read it, and it sounds like a very positive thing, even though God didn't tell them to do it. Which is why some people have said, this is why in the Christian calendar, we add things like Thanksgiving, we add things like the celebration of Christmas, even though it's not commanded in the Bible. It is a variation on themes in the Bible where we are encouraged by certain things God says to come up with new ways to reflect the same kind of thing. So if you ever struggled whether you should celebrate Christmas, that's the answer. End of footnote, few verses left in chapter 10. The work of providence continues into the future. The work of providence reverses threats against God's people. The work of providence merits celebration. And the work of providence continues into the future. Chapter 10. King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea. And all the acts of his power and might and the full account of the high honor of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers. For he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. End of book. And so the book wraps up, and the word peace is right there, very prominent. Things are peaceful, and Mordecai is speaking peace. You might wonder why it adds the comment that King Ahasuerus imposed tax in verse 1. That doesn't seem like a positive thing. And there are different possibilities. Maybe the idea is things sort of went back to normal for Xerxes, and he was back to his old ways of doing whatever he pleased and growing his bank account and looking to resolve his financial woes and whatever else. But at the same time, just because life sort of goes back to normal and there aren't just all these amazing things happening all the time, God is still at work. And God's going to continue blessing. Or, an even more positive spin, just like God's going to curse those who curse his people, Ahasuerus sided with the Jews. And his kingdom prospers as a result. I think we see the hand of God there as well. But the main point is Mordecai. That he is promoted to this position. He has this influence for good among the people of God. And why am I saying that that has to do with the future? Because in the next generation, the next Persian empire, or the next Persian emperor, is not always going to side with the people of God. Maybe we should continue a series now into Ezra and Nehemiah. There are actually a lot of problems they face because of pressures from these very same people. And if this book was written that early, it would have communicated the message, look, things are bad, these people are very volatile, and you never know when they're going to change their mind and stand against you, but look what happened to Mordecai. God turned that around and put him in this high position of influence. And by the way, Ezra and Nehemiah also get very prominent positions alongside the Persian emperors and as their delegates to be a blessing to the people of God. So the threats are never going to end while this earth continues in this era. But God has done plenty to assure you. And he ends on this point that there's this long-term ministry of Mordecai making the point, no matter what's going to come up next, no matter what other Haman may be sort of hanging out in the shadows, just ready to come back, it's okay. God's committed to his people. God's going to work this out. And there is peace that he is assuring for them in the end. I'd like to summarize, not just this sermon, but in a way the whole book of Esther, with this theme statement, that providence explains past deliverances, and it also anticipates future ones. Walk away with that and see it fulfilled climactically in the work of Christ, who not only was threatened to die or threatened to be killed, but actually was killed. And the reversal occurs 3 days later on the resurrection. And take that as a further assurance that every other deliverance that the Lord has promised, he is going to work out as well, just like he did in this book. Providence explains past deliverances and anticipates future ones. Leaving us with these thoughts of application, I want to encourage you, as we have done here with Esther, to study carefully the work of God in history. Be looking for his hand as you read all these stories. Focus in on the details and how things match up to problems that came up earlier and how God is so wisely arranging and orchestrating all these things. And celebrate that work. We shouldn't wait till October 24th to have our lunch. We ought to have a Purim feast right now since we finished Esther and have a big party right now. All right, maybe somebody would just take us down to Pizza Inn or something. This is worth shouting about. This is worth praising God for. This is amazing. Worship him. Rejoice in it. Celebrate it. That's where the book ends. It's a big party. And take heart. The next time things aren't so upbeat and you're back in the face of a threat and something that doesn't make sense, the Lord has worked in the past, and he is committed to continuing to bless and guide, provide his people to enjoy everything he has promised, whether that would be his people Israel or whether that would be his people the church.